This is part two of a shiur about individualism within Avodas Hashem, based on the writings and the teachings of Rav Amitel. I had delivered the first part of the shiur and had halted in the middle. The shiur had to be delayed for a few minutes to get a sefer, and I forgot to record the conclusion of the shiur, so this is just the parts that were omitted. The previous year had ended with a very famous piece of the Vilna Gaon in Mishlei, in which he asserts that during the period of Nevuah, each person would receive direct, supernatural, prophetic guidance to try to identify their own personality and character and try to shape their Avodas Hashem accordingly. But in a post-Nevuah age, even though in theory that same personalization could occur because each person has access to Ruach HaKodesh, it's hard to know whether you're operating on the purity of Ruach HaKodesh or you're operating based on selfish, self-interested agendas. And therefore, the Vilna Gaon suggested more of a shutdown of personalization, a conformity of action, and whatever thought and motivation should be to try to fulfill Hashem's overarching will rather than trying to find your own personal voice in Avodas Hashem. And many people would see that statement as almost a blueprint for the types of Avodas Hashem that many communities try to look towards today. Rav Kook disagreed, and Rav Amitel quoted three pieces of Rav Kook for us, each with a different tone and a different flavor to it. Again, part of the disagreement is period and context. The Vilna Gaon is operating in the 18th century, and that's still a world of metaphysics and of objective reality and of in which people saw themselves through absolute objective terms. We live in a world of existentialism in which people are looking for their own subjective narrative. They process the world inside out rather than outside in. It's hard for us to really identify with their experience because it's so vastly different from our own. And even when we do try to understand it, to the simple mind, it seems as if it's inferior, but it just isn't. It's just a different way to live life. It's based on assuming there are absolute truths, and you live your life through the prism of those truths rather than living your life through the prism of your own identity and your own consciousness. So, for example, to highlight the difference, the classic problem for philosophers of theodicy. God is omnipotent. He's also benevolent. How can you justify the presence of evil in our world? And obviously, from time immemorial, philosophy has struggled to resolve this issue. So the Rambam solves the issue, quote unquote, when he claims that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by definition, is incapable of creating evil, because he's so benevolent. Hashem can only, by definition, create good and welfare, but he doesn't distribute it equitably. So if a person's blind, it's not as if Hashem made him blind, because Hashem is incapable of creating defects. Hashem just didn't give him enough sight. Hashem creates sight, but didn't offer him enough sight. Or if a person is born, a person is hungry and poor, Hashem didn't create conditions of hunger and poverty. Hashem just didn't give this person enough resources or food. And for medievalists, this works, because you've solved their view of God as an omnipotent and benevolent God, and they're submitting to that system, and they're able to deal with their world. But think of it in our terms, existentialist, subjectivist terms, in our age. Think about going over to a poor person and consoling him by saying, don't worry, you're not really poor, you just don't have enough money. Or going to a blind person and saying, don't worry, you're not really blind, you just don't have enough sight. It wouldn't wash, it wouldn't have an impact, but it did 300-400 years ago, because people just saw their world in a completely different perspective. Objectivism, absolutism, metaphysics, rather than our world of existentialism, subjective reality. And before you sign up for our world, just realize all the challenges that are accompanying our reality. Moral subjectivism, lack of absolutes, lack of fixed values, moral self-arbitration. So indeed, there are certain benefits of living existentially, but there are some great, great prices we've paid. In any event, it makes sense for the Vilna Gaon in the 18th century to suggest that we're past the age of specialization, because we no longer have nevuah and we can't trust our instincts to navigate through Ruach HaKodesh and identify our personalized and specialized form of Avodas Hashem. And therefore, not just should the activities be similar, but even to a degree, the internal motivation. But now Rav Kook is living in the 20th century, and it's a different world. And it's at least feasible and reasonable that the Vilna Gaon statement may not be that effective for many groups of sincerely firm Jews. And Rav Kook is writing in a very, very different tone. So, for example, and again, for those who haven't really read Rav Kook in Hebrew or inside, they're very densely written pieces. They're very poetic. Ideally, you have to read the entire piece and not get caught up on a particular word and what it means, because it's poetry. It's not prose. And poetry has a holistic feel to it and a song and a rhythm that conveys meaning beyond this word or that word. Imagine a song that you listen to. You appreciate the song. In many cases, you don't even understand the words. In some cases, it's better not to understand every word, because that fixes certain imagery rather than allowing some of the imagery to remain ambiguous in general. So I'll just try to read some of Rav Kook in Hebrew just to convey some of that poetic feel. This is in Orot HaKodesh, Chelek Gimel. Kol Adam Tzarich Ladat. Everyone has to appreciate. Shekaroi hu lavod al pi ofen ha'akara v'hargasha ha'miyuchad shelo. You're summoned to serve Hashem based on your own personal awareness and feelings. Al pi sharesh nishmato, based on the root of whom you are, your identity. And then he says, Al yival belu tochnim shel tfiyam el tocho me'olamot zarim. Don't be confused by qualities and content that is foreign to you simply because it's popular. But it's foreign to you, and of course, because of that foreignness and it's alien, you pay the price of authenticity. Right? Obviously, the goal of personalized religion is authenticity. This danger is that in the search for authenticity, you may witness diminishing standards. But be afraid, or he says, don't be concerned, don't be afraid by these foreign ideas, she'inam kol tam kihogen, which you're not capable of absorbing. She'inam mukhshar li'agdam yafa b'tzara chayim shelo. That you can't possibly internalize because they're not whom you are. Ela olamot yimtzu tikunam bimkamam. Those worlds and those theaters and venues will be repaired and affected by other people. Etzel ha'mesugalim l'vinyanam b'shichlulam. Other people who are different from you, who are suited to those other ventures and venues. Avol hu, each person, tzarech l'rakes et chayav ba'olamotav hu. You've got to focus your attention and your investment in your inner world. Be'olamot ha'pnimiyim shelo. Shehem lo, your inner world is as encompassing as the entire universe. And he quotes the famous Chazal, Chayev Adam Lomar Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, which connotes that every human being is a self-sufficient, independent universe and has enough space for growth and development without visiting other foreign or alien universes. And then Rav Kook says, and this is where the paradox sets in, that this self-sufficiency and personalization and finding your space, as we would say in the modern jargon, and your form and your role, it stems from two paradoxical traits. On the one hand, there's a godless, there's a sweep, there's a large expanded imagination to be able to see in yourself the type of infinite space that doesn't require other space and other worlds. Bishvili nivra ha'olam. You are your own cosmos, and there's enough to retain you and enough for you to invest in that cosmos without trying to graft other worlds that are very, very foreign to you. On the other hand, this stems not just from godless, but from anivus, to know that you can't do it all, and you don't have to do it all, and you could be your own role player, so to speak, in a larger kaleidoscope of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Bria. And whenever you experience paradox in Avodas Hashem, that's typically a sign of growth, because But I think this is latent in the words and the writings of the Rav. Our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and with the infinite world of our interacting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a disproportionate relationship. We're Basar V'dam, and he's Melech Malchayim Lachim. So we can't expect the interface between ourselves and HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be mediated by one rational, reasonable feature. Are we supposed to love Hashem? Are we supposed to fear Hashem? The answer is both, and that typically doesn't play out in our human interfaces. There are objects we love and objects we fear. But that's because when we're dealing with human objects, human people, human-based objects, if I'm holding a cup of water, I either want to drink it or I don't want to drink it. I don't have a paradox in my relationship with a cup of water because it's scaled to human size. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is beyond the types of human access points. And therefore, there have to be multiple access points that oftentimes run paradoxically. And when you hit paradox in Avodas Hashem, you're not meant to in any way resolve it, but to indulge in it and invest in it because you'll deepen the interaction with HaKadosh Baruch Hu or his mitzvahs. Take, for example, a relationship in our world, in our lives, that is deeper than our normal pedestrian day-to-day experiences, our relationship with people very close to us, our spouses, our parents, our children, our siblings. We love them so deeply, and because we love them so deeply, we're also hurt by them at the same time that we love them just as deeply. And that's a paradox. How could you be hurt or love and then feel love towards the same person? And the answer is because those are relationships that aren't scaled, so to speak, into transient and fleeting human experiences, such as your relationship with a cup of water or with someone that you're sitting next to on a plane. Those are deep, emotionally embedded relationships. And once you enter that realm of complexity, there are going to be paradoxes that inevitably emerge. So when you're thinking about limiting yourself to your own suitable form of Avodas Hashem, rather than trying to graft or fuse areas that aren't natural to you, that stems from two different contrasting and dichotomous traits. On the one hand, a godless, so you realize how much each person is, and you have to be content within that sweep of your own humanity, but also a nivus, humility, that there are others that are different from you, and they'll attend to the other worlds that are not natural to you. And the book writes, Gidola an visonis zu ma'asherasi es adam. This type of humility creates, osher, creates happiness, satisfaction, gratification, and leads to shleimus. So this is Rav Kook's first volley, urging specialization, attributing it to two different contrasting traits, and warning us about grafting foreign elements onto our Avodas Hashem. A little bit later in Simin Tesvav, he writes, Misha nishmato hi shirit piyutit. He gives an example. Some people, by their nature, are very poetic. They're very aesthetic. They're very, they enjoy the arts and music and color. Some people, by their nature, are much more mathematical. They're discrete thinkers. About 20 years ago, people were experimenting with different ways to structure libraries. Our libraries are structured based on the Dewey Decimal System. So 0.0001 till 0.0004 contains the science books, and 0.0004 to 0.0008 will contain history books. But the claim is that epistemologically, which is a fancy way of saying how we acquire knowledge, the thought goes that people don't process knowledge and wisdom in that form of segmentation, as if there's a part of their brain in which they're involved in history, and then part of a brain in which they're thinking about math, and part of a brain in which they're studying science. But the imagery of more of a hub and spokes, like a wheel, and each person has a different hub. So a poet, his hub will be poetry. And as he adds spokes to that wheel, namely, when he studies math, he'll study math from a poetic standpoint. When he studies history, He'll study history from a poetical. He'll see history, math, science through the prism of poetry. And for a different person, their hub will be mathematical. And as they add spokes to their hub, so they'll study history from a mathematical standpoint. And for one person, their hub will be historical. And they'll study math through a historical lens. And there was an attempt in some way to fashion libraries in that manner, more flexible, allowing people to almost build their own models based on their own inclination. It's always important not to limit yourself. Sometimes people see themselves and tag themselves. Well, I'm a scientist, and I don't ever want to read a poem or look at a piece of art because it's not finite and structured enough. And it's important to be able to create that appreciation of the human spirit, to create spirit, to appreciate spirit. Other times you find people saying, well, I'm a person of humanities, and math just doesn't speak to me. And it's so important to diversify. It's so important to train your mind to work in different ways. But not just train your mind, train your personality, how much math lends to your ability to analyze yourself and not get confused. Very often, people will come over to me with questions, and I'll tell them, almost instinctively, you're asking three questions, and let's deal with each of them independently. Because more often than not, our predicaments in life are very complex. And the complexity is a product of overlapping variables. And if we're able to just isolate the variables, sometimes the answers are simpler than we think. It's true in learning Gemara also. Every sugya is five or six variables operating at once, and you can't analyze all six of them at once. Very few people have a mind that can be such an acrobat. More often, as you proceed through a sugya, you're fixing one variable and analyzing a different variable, and then flipping the switch and fixing the variable that you analyze while analyzing the variable that you fixed. And this type of thinking and processing is what math yields, because it's this discrete and structured. And people who limit themselves essentially aren't providing any spokes to their wheel. They have a hub, they know who they are, but they don't add enough spokes, and the wheels never really turn well enough. They don't spin, and there's no traction. So Rav Kook is discussing someone who is by nature a poetic spirit. Sarachu ladas is tunato. You should understand that spirit, your desires, your feelings, and hamazon haruchani hamyuchadlo, and the special spiritual nutrition that's suited for you. Hanidrash l'sipuk chayata ruchanit, that you need for your spiritual satisfaction, as if you need air. And even though, of course, Rav Kook agrees that there can't be ultimate personalization in the world of action, everyone has to conform to the same activities, the imgam yishtatef imshar balei kishronot biyeter hadrishot ruchaniot, even though you're behaving and acting and practicing along with other people in a uniform fashion, but they are very different from you, lo yishkach leolam, don't ever forget, shehu nitba, that you're demanded, this is not just an option, this is a demand, you're demanded from Hashem because you're different, to maintain your own personal identity in Avodas Hashem. And then a little bit later, in Arot HaTara Perek Tet, not Arot HaKodesh, a different sefer, Rav Kook actually speaks very, very portentously about the dangers of acting out of character, and in particular studying Torah in ways or forms of Torah that just don't fit you. Very often, people ask me when they leave yeshiva what Torah they should study. And more often than not, my answer is twofold. Primarily, they should study Torah based on what interests them, based on what they're passionate about, as Rav Kook will describe in a moment. And it's important primarily from a practical standpoint, because it probably won't last unless it's affiliated with passion and excitement. Second of all, because not only are we interested in Torah lasting, but we want it to be fastened to the core of your identity, not something which is external or extrinsic to your identity. And passion is a very, very deeply rooted human emotion. I also tell them, of course, to learn to discriminate between Torah proper and books about religion or talks. And I want them to be able to realize that reading Dvar Hashem, a pasuk, a Mishnah, a Gemara, a Medrash, is fundamentally different than reading Rabbi Sacks on religion, who I have utmost esteem for. But that's not Dvar Hashem. That's Dvar Basar Vadam, reading a man's voice who can very eloquently articulate our attitudes to religion. And of course, those voices and ideas are absolutely vital and should be read and should be applied. But there's something fundamental about Talmud Torah and interacting and engaging in Dvar Hashem. And a lot of people don't fully appreciate that difference and don't fully, and I was giving the shiur to females yesterday and I tried to highlight to them that for males, that difference is absolutely crucial. Every male has a chiyuv min haTorah to study Torah in a regular fashion. And by and large, that mitzvah, that obligation has to be met through Torah itself, the study of Hashem's word. And Baruch Hashem, today there's access for almost every human being to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah in whatever language and at whatever level. And I don't think it's fair for a person to acquit themselves from their chiyuv of Talmud Torah by reading books about religion. And part of what made Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein's Torah about religion so riveting and important is it was always based very, very deeply on the Makaros. I mean, this year that I'm giving the second part of now had about 30 Makaros to it. I'll try to upload the source sheet. So even though we were speaking about religion and religious values, it was deeply, deeply centered on Mikaros, Psukim, Mishnayos, Midrashim, Gemaros. And of course, even for women who don't carry the absolute chiyuv of Talmud Torah, and they're allowed to invest their religious energies and expressions in other fields, but certainly we feel that the contact with the Dvar Hashem is so ennobling and so important and revitalizing that I want women to be aware of that difference also. And especially for women who have been trained towards text-based Talmud Torah, to be able to draw that difference between reading a Pasuk and reading a Rashi, or reading a Mishnah and reading a Gemara, as opposed to reading a book which articulates religious values or articulates our view of Torah. So you have to choose what you'll learn very wisely. And Rav Kook is concerned that people who choose Torah that doesn't fit their personality, it can sometimes sour them to Torah, and because Torah is so central and fundamental to religion, it can sour them and alienate them from religion. And I've, sadly enough, personally seen people who became so deeply invested in learning types of Torah that didn't fit their interests, their passion, their abilities, that it did create this alienation, and ultimately some of them are no longer from, because it really drove them far away from religious experience and from religious satisfaction. And Rav Kook articulates this, Kol echad tzarech la'asok be'esek shelo. Everyone, again, has to be personalized and find their calling. Uv'yichud ha'davar nahoeg, and especially binyanei limud, when you're studying Torah. Yesh nam she'yatzu le'tarbut ra'a. Some people actually left religious practice. B'bnei she'bederech limudam b'hashlamatam ruchanit, because when they chose what to study, they betrayed their identity. They chose the type of learning that wasn't fit for them. Now, this is a very, very provocative statement with a lot of consequences across the board, especially since we more or less create standardized curriculums through our high school with slight flexibilities and variations based on the unique skills of the student. But at least when a person matures and has a higher self-awareness, the Torah curriculum that he or she chooses should be specifically suited and specifically reflective of their persona. Anyway, Rav Amital concluded this year, having quoted this, so to speak, machlokas between the Vilna Gaon and Rav Kook, and I don't want to say it's a machlokas because they were talking to two very, very different generations and living in two very different periods of history. Rav Amital talked about dangers of individualization of religion. Again, the intellectual honesty that we were always exposed to both by Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein, and it was almost commonplace for every shiur to end with, well, what are the dangers of this approach and how do you balance yourself so that you don't become excessive and become polarized in a particular trait. So first of all, Rav Amital felt that individualization can lead a person to be disconnected with society, unconcerned with society's view of him, not really caring about people's opinion, not living within a context of Derech Eretz. The Torah says in Parshas Yisro, Hashem informs Moshe that he's going to speak directly to the Jewish people. Moshe is actually relating this to Am Yisrael. Levavur nasos eschem bahar elokim. Hashem is coming to speak with you, to raise your experience. Uva'avur tihye yir aso al penechem levilti techato. So that the yira will literally be on your face. And that's a strange expression. Yira Shemayim will be on your face, and Hashem is therefore speaking to you directly. So the Gemara interprets this as a reference to busha. Because when a person feels embarrassment, their face turns red. So this is Yira Shemayim that you can detect on someone's face. How does busha yield Yira Shemayim? And what is busha? Well, busha is shame. Not the shame of falling on some ice or slipping on a banana peel, but the shame of underperforming based on society's expectations, the shame of not living based on expectations, norms, betraying society's demands or anticipations of you and from you. And I think that sadly enough, we live in a world in which busha has to a degree receded. I think some of our politicians and public figures have created a world in which they don't care about what people think about them, and they will snub their nose at you, and in some cases even intentionally look to grab headlines by acting in ways that are eye-raising and eyebrow-raising. And it's not a healthy moral condition. A healthier moral condition is where people are, to a degree, concerned with expectations and feel embarrassed when they don't conform or serve those expectations. Again, not subservient or enslaved to expectations, it's a balance, but it's very, very delicate to be an individualist without becoming someone who is severed, or I would call them a secessionist, where you secede from society and you are such a loner and you're so solitary in your experience that you don't really care about other people. And that's a very dangerous place to be morally. It's a very dangerous place to be interactively. And to a degree, it's a very dangerous place to be religiously, because one of the natural checks and balances for Avodas Hashem is society's expectations. We can't expect every person to perform religion based on inner motivation. And a healthy degree of social pressure is crucial. And that's why the Gemara says, Kol HaMizbayesh, whoever feels busha, the Gemara Nedarim says, Mochel Lo Kol Avonosav, he no longer has to worry so much about his chait, because there's a natural corrective. So one danger of individualism is secession, being so individualistic that it becomes almost egotistical, cocky, solitary, living out of the reach and interests of society. Society no longer interests you. Other people don't interest you. Second danger Avital spoke about is related, but it's not that you're not interested in the people that you live with in society and their impressions or observations, but you're just not interested in humanity. You create this narrative where my own world and my own inner peace and my own inner nirvana is the only factor, and I have to completely shut down not just my neighbor or the person sitting in shul next to me, but humanity and progress and culture and civilization. And Rav Amital was speaking very critically in those days about people who went to India. And at least the little that I gather, not having been in India, what's so attractive to especially Israeli trekkers and backpackers about India is that there's such pressure of achievement in Israel. And the contrast in India, where, again, this is the way it's reported to me, this is what they find attractive in the parts of India that they visit, where there's this very, very relaxed attitude where there's no time and there's no watch and there's no calendar and everyone is only interested in their own inner tranquility and not an advancing society. That whole pressure to grow and to achieve has been alleviated. Ramital felt that was also a cop-out or an excuse, and an excuse that individualism could yield. So that's the second nature, not just living out of concern or separate from the people around you, which can provide healthy norms and expectations, but living divorced from any sense of commitment and responsibility to the overall human condition and the advancement of the human condition. And the third danger of individualism, Rav Amital hinted at this, and this is based on a beautiful Rashi and a Medrash in Parshas Naso about conflicting reports. When did the Levim begin their service? At the age of 25 or at the age of 30? So the Medrash reconciles that they began their training at the age of 25, but they trained for 5 years. So that effectively, after 5 years of training, they were 30 years old, and they began their actual work and service. So this Medrash really carries two issues. One issue, which is the direct statement of the Medrash, is that if you don't succeed in learning in 5 years, perhaps it's not for you, and perhaps you have to switch tracks, because that was the upper limit allocated to the Levim to train. So after 5 years of training, perhaps they have to switch gears. But I think for Rav Amital, and to me certainly, the more compelling message of the Medrash is that in order to accomplish something in life meaningful, you have to really work at it, and you have to really invest massively over long periods of time, even if it takes you 5 years. And I think that given all the forces in our world, we're becoming less capable of long-term investment and massive, massive commitment for many reasons. But very often, we switch gears too quickly and too rapidly and too frequently in the name of individualism. Well, this isn't for me. Now I'm going to find something which is for me, and I'm going to express my personal spirit and let my spirit wander. Individualism can become a mask to camouflage lack of commitment, lack of investment, where you're very, very non-committal and very uninvested, and you tell yourself it's because I'm trying to find my true inner self, and the true inner self changes. And sometimes you've got to be committed to larger programs and agendas that in a very general sense fit you, but may not match your state of mind or state of being in every single moment and every single day. But there's a longer enduring goal that overrides the shifts and oscillations in your personal internal clock for that particular day. So these were the three challenges of rampant individualism, which Rav Amital warned against: severing yourself from interest in how people see you and the corrective factor of busha, severing yourself from the course of humanity, because your internal world is in and of itself a cosmos, and finally, displaying or lacking fastidiousness and commitment stick-to-itiveness and persistence and stamina, because you have to constantly calibrate your investments based on the whims and caprices of that particular moment.